is Michael and I'm a compulsive overeater. You know, when Chris asked me to do this, it was really ironic because when you look at the 12 steps in a macro sense, a lot of people get very anxious about 4 and 8 and 9. You know, those are considered the big steps. And for me, 2 and 3 were really the big steps. Because coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity was a lift, because I had assumed that God was either dead or God had given up us on us as a species, because really, who could blame him, right? We're a mess. Okay, so I grew up in Philadelphia, in a working class neighborhood, and my father worked in a garage. My mother was a housewife, and we were Irish Catholic, and we were very ritualized that way. We went to church every week. My grandmother was very, very religious, and we, I grew up with the trappings of the church, right? I know that a lot of people get on OA meetings and they really bash the Catholics, and I get it. Like I do. A lot of people turn their back on organized religion, and I don't consider myself Catholic anymore. But I will say that the trappings of it all, like the incense, the stained glass, the quiet, the organ, all of that really did feed me spiritually as a child. It really did connect me to something that was sort of bigger than me. It just was when I got older and
Came
came
out
out
of
of
the
the closet.
closet.
Are we here? Okay. That I really sort of turned my back on all that. You know what I mean? And look, they get to have their rules. They have, and that's fine. You know what I mean? Like, religions have rules, and like, this is what we stand for. And if you're not part of this, then you don't belong with us. And I think that's okay. But it left me unmoored. It left me without sort of any really inkling of a higher power. And the more older and the more cynical, frankly, I became as an adult, the more I was convinced that God didn't exist. I became sort of hardcore agnostic about the whole thing. I wasn't really an atheist. I didn't have the belief that there was nothing bigger than us. I didn't have that kind of hubris, but I did not believe that there was a sort of munificent God who was going to look out for me in my day-to-day life and make things easier or show me a path or any of the things that people of faith actually believed. Of course, this only helped feed my disease as a compulsive overeater, right? I mean, when you don't have a faith tradition, when you don't have a belief in anything bigger than yourself in a true sense, food became my God. And when I needed to numb out, when I needed to sort of not feel things, then that's what happened. I had food, and it got me that initial burst of that first 15 minutes when you binge, you know what I mean? Which just does sort of take the noise away. And then, of course, what happens afterwards is a disaster, right? Because you feel ugly and guilty and fat and terrible, and then you have to eat more and more in order to get that same high again. And it's a, this sort of cycle that we've all been on, hamster wheel, we all sort of traveled at one point or other that brought us to a room like this. When I decided, it took me a long time to come to OA. I was in my 50s. I'm 62 now. And a friend brought me to an OA meeting here in LA. I was visiting her. I was still in Philly. And she brought me to an OA meeting and in person. And I thought, oh, these are lovely people, and this is a cult. And I just thought, now I give up sugar. I mean, you might as well have asked me to amputate my right arm. I was not giving up sugar. There was no way that was going to happen. I couldn't even fathom it. It was my biggest crutch in life. So I left the meeting and I actually went and binged. I mean, because that's really smart, right? To eat at people. I used to do that all the time. And it took me a couple more years in 2020 during the pandemic when I literally had no clothes left that fit. And to come to this program, because the pandemic was a gift if you have a sort of disease like this. What it does is that it sort of makes you be alone. It makes you be alone with your food. Nobody's watching, and you can just do whatever you want, which I did. I was already quite large by the pandemic, but then gained 35 pounds during the pandemic in the first 6 months, that March to August of 2020. And And literally had no clothes left that fit. I mean, I'm not even exaggerating. I literally had nothing left. I was about to wear the bedspread. Like, it was just terrible. One night ended up on the floor. My father had died in 2013, and he had been in AA for 25 years and had an amazing recovery. And I was talking to him and sobbing one night, literally on my bedroom floor. And I just said, I can't do this anymore. I cannot. Can you get me where you are? Because I can't be here. I just don't want to be here. I wouldn't have harmed myself, but I wouldn't have minded a bus hitting me, you know? And I heard my dad say, go to bed. So I did. And the next day, I logged on to my first OA meeting online. And that was the day of my entry into OA on August 18th of 2020. And so, you know, I was desperate. I had that gift, right? But I did not yet have the gift of a belief in something bigger than me. So step one, I breezed through. I was like, yeah, I'm powerless over this. Like, forget it. I can't manage this another minute. So that was okay. But then two and three came, and I was like, oof, okay. It was really difficult for me to believe that God existed and that B, that God would care enough to care whether I was going to eat a donut. It just seemed illogical in the scheme of a God of the world. And what I was missing was that sense of a personal God who was there for me, you know, a higher power who belonged to me and was there, you know, munificently, lovingly, and 24/7 for me. And what I really learned through two and three, through those steps, was that God had actually been there the whole time. But I had my back to God. And all I had to do was turn around. But it took me a long time to turn around. And I picked a sponsor who, ironically, was 30 years younger than me because he was so chill and so zen. And I just thought, you have what I want. I want to be chill like you. I want to just not let life get in this much. I was extremely reactive all the time. I was constantly scorekeeping injury and slights and insults, and I had a withering ability to strike back at people. I can't imagine to this day looking back how I had any friends because I was not a very pleasant person to be around all the time, especially when I was in the food. And I turned to God and said, all right, you know, when I was in the middle of step two, and I said to my sponsor, look, I don't know. I don't know if I can come to believe this, you know? And he said, well, can you try? And I said, sure. I mean, it seemed like the minimum amount of effort required. And so one day I got on my bedroom floor, I lit a candle. I still do this. This is still my spiritual practice. I lit a candle, sat on my bedroom floor, and I knocked on the floor and I said, hi, God, it's me. I don't know if you're there, but people tell me you're there. So I'm going to go with it because I don't have anything left to lose at this point. And so here's what's going on. And I talked for an hour out loud. I said, I've had it. I'm sad. I hate myself. I can't look in a mirror. I can't live without the food. I don't know how to do this. I mean, everything just all came out, right? Decades of destruction and of self-loathing and of panic and of self-abuse came out in that hour. And when I was done, I blew out the candle. And I said, okay, good chat. And then I didn't know how to feel, honestly. I can't tell you that like the sun streamed in through the stained glass and I was like, oh, like that's not how it happened. It was a slow burn. But I did feel better. I knew that. I knew I felt better. And that was enough. I just thought, okay, I don't know if I still am skeptical about this, but you know what? I feel better. And so anything that's going to make me feel better and going to make me feel more connected to the idea of these steps and this program and recovery, I'm going with. And so that was the beginning of my spiritual practice, right? Came to believe. And then becoming willing to turn my life and my will over, whew, okay. I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, I do believe that there's something bigger in here that's looking out for me. And that took a while. But then sort of making the leap beyond that to, okay, this God of my understanding is actually going to run the show. I'm going to hand the keys of the car over and buckle into the passenger seat and sort of go for the ride. That was really rough. I was a very type A personality. I sort of still am. I had an amazing career because of that. You know, I'm a writer by trade. And, you know, I just, to me, it felt like defeatist. It felt like, oof, you know what I mean? Like giving up control, not being the actor, right? Not being able to tell everybody here, you do this, and everything will be fine. That was really hard. That was really tough. It took me a long time to do step three. And I thought at some point my sponsor was going to be like, look, fella, you know, put up or shut up. But he was very gentle because he knew something I didn't at the time, which I have now passed on to my sponsees, which is people come to the step work differently, and different steps take longer for different people because of their life and lived experience. And so for me, he said to me, look, you have to do the steps. Like, that's why I'm here. But I want you to do them right, not quickly. And if it takes you longer, that's fine. We're going to keep talking about it, but you have to keep working at it. You can't just sort of give up and say, this step isn't for me. You cannot window shop your way through this program, right? And skip, well, I don't really like three. Five's not my favorite. I'm going to skip to eight. Like, that's not how it works. The reason the steps are the steps is because they ascend, right? This is a staircase that goes to your God of your understanding and to a better life, right? I don't think that's an accident from these guys in the 30s who put this thing together. I think that metaphor is actually makes sense. But you know, just like you can't skip steps on a staircase, you'll break your hip, you cannot skip the steps you don't like. And I didn't like three, but I couldn't skip it. And I think what happened was I came to see that that there was a payoff to all of this. That basically what happened is things started to happen. And I started to do two-way prayer, where I would sort of talk to God and then I'd get answers back. And the only reason I still believe in two-way prayer is because the answers I got back were never what I wanted to hear. I would ask a question and then get direction, and then I wouldn't want to hear it. Very famous incident. I was in program about a year at this point. I was living in Philadelphia still. I live in LA now. And I was walking down the street, and there's an unhoused person begging for money on the street. And I walk by him. I don't give him any money. So God says, I hear God say in loud, go back and give him money. And I say to God, I only have a 20. I'm not giving a homeless person a $20 bill. No. I keep walking. Now I'm like three blocks down. God says, no, you are. You won't miss the $20. The $20 is going to make a huge difference in his life. Go back and give him the $20. This goes on for five blocks. I'm not joking. Five blocks. I was almost at my destination. And then I was like, damn it. Turned around. Walked back, gave the guy 20 bucks. He would look at me like, what? But that's what I did. See, I took direction that I didn't want to take because, believe me, that was not my idea. Absolutely not. And I get that kind of direction all the time. You know, when I want to come down on somebody at work because they're being mean or they're being inefficient, and then God says, that's not us anymore. That's not the way this works. You know that. Come on. God's always like giving me the elbow, like, come on, you know. I was at a meeting last week. I'm the co-secretary of a meeting here in LA, and a fellow showed up who I hadn't seen in months, and I had texted him about 6 weeks ago, and he hadn't texted me back. In front of the other fellows, I went to him and said, hey, you didn't text me back, jerko, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, and then on my way home from the meeting, God said, yeah, that good thing to do. Was that really helpful? Was that like, or what do you think? And I was like, oh, no. Did the 10th step, called him, apologize. I mean, you know, again, this is all God. Like, I would not do any of this without a higher power in my corner who was guiding me, because I make terrible decisions. When I make decisions, I have dinner parties whose guest list only include Duncan Hines and Betty Crocker. That's my idea of good decision making, you know? When God makes the decisions for me, I make really good decisions. I have not made a bad decision that I've turned over to God in the entire 5.5 years I've been at Pergram. I'll leave you with this, which is
Just a
about.
heads up, you have 2 extra minutes on what you're seeing.
Okay, I have 2 extra minutes. Okay, great. Thank you. So I was in program about 6 months when my mother died. And she and I were really close. She was a complete food pusher. You know, she would not, I never told her I was in program. It just didn't matter. But I loved her to death. She was like the great old Irish chick. And then the week after she died, I got laid off from my job. So this is like high stress, right? Like, I'm like, if you ever want to eat, this is when you want to eat. And I was really lost because I was in my 50s. That's a hard age to be looking for another job, as many of you probably know. And I've just lost my mom, and I'm rootless. And I had always thought of moving to California, but I had never sort of been able to make it happen. And I was just like sort of just at wit's end. And I would really been thinking about the food. And you know, and the worst part is that you know when somebody close to you dies, the first thing that happens is people start sending food. People started sending all this food to my mom's house. I was there with my brothers, and one day one of my brothers came to me and he handed me a big basket of food that I could not eat. It was not my food. And he said, "Here, I want you to take this home. We each got to take this home. It's going to go bad." And I said, "I can't take this. No." I said, "I can take this thing, but not the rest of it." And he said, and now he knew I was in program, right? I'd been in program 6, 7 months. And I had lost a considerable amount of weight, you know. And he turned to me and he said, "Michael, come on. We all know you're going to be fat again. Just take the food." Here's the thing. That would have broken me. That kind of comment before higher power was in my corner and before I had a higher power to sort of lean into in a moment like that. And I instantly heard God say to me, "That's not true. And you know that's not true. Don't take it. And it's going to be fine. And he doesn't understand. And it's okay that he doesn't understand." And so I did. Not only did I not take the food, but the real win was I didn't lash out at him for saying that to me. I was like, "Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's true, and but you know, that's okay. I'm not taking it." And so and that was it, right? The real revelation, I should say, came after that, because it was about a week or two after that when I was really down and I was really like, then your financial insecurity comes up because now you're out of a job and you know, my emotional ballast, my mom, you know, that sort of huggy mom I had, and she's gone. And I said to God, "Look, I just one day I just stood in my living room and I said, I'm really scared here. I don't know what to do." And God said to me, as clear as if one of you said it to me, "Repeat after me, my new life is coming." And I said, "Okay, my new life is coming." And God said to me louder. And I screamed in the middle of my living room and put my arms out and said, "My new life is coming." And my new life showed up. 6 months later, I moved to California. I got an amazing job. I made great friends at an age when people don't make new friends. I live in the sunshine. I had financial security. My relationship with my family is solid. I've had some setbacks, but when I have them, I can handle them because I've got God in my corner because I turned around. And that's all you got to do is turn around. Thank you so much for letting me share with you today. God bless you all.
Thank you very much, Michael. Everyone, please give it up for Michael. Again, man, thank you very much for showing up today and sharing. Really quick before we get to our next speaker, Amy, are you able to access the timer? Okay, are you able to use your phone and just give them a fantastic. Cool.
Absolutely. Got you covered. Next,
All right.
Miriam.
Awesome. All right. Well, everyone, please welcome sharing now, Miriam S.
Hi, I'm Miriam, compulsive overeater. It's being on the spot sometimes can be a little bit like, oh, okay, but I'm just going to share my experience, strength, and hope. And I used to cry at night when I was eating, and I used to every night I remember this. I used to cry going, God, why did you give me this? Of all things, why did you make me fat? Because I wanted to be thin. I wanted to be a normal weight more than anything, and I couldn't. I would eat every single night, and I would wake up in the morning going, God, I did it again. I did it again. And tomorrow is a new day. I'll start today. And then I would break it, and it really became hell on earth. And I don't know why, but for some reason, I'm grateful, and I was led to OA when I was 18, 1 week before I was 18. And I always think, God, I could talk longer than 20 minutes, believe me, but I wanted to stop eating more than anything. And I truly believe that I'm an alcoholic with food, that I have the ism. And for me, it's food. It could have been alcohol, it could have been drugs, but for me, it was food. It's always been food. And my mom said, why don't you go to OA? And my experience was when I came to OA in Reseda, California, that was the beginning of the path. And I really believe that if you're new here or you're struggling or whatever, like if we're here, there is a higher power that can stop us from compulsive overeating. And I hung out in the rooms for 6 years. I really did the best I could, though. I did not really surrender to God or a higher power until hanging out for 6 years. So I always say this, it's like if you're like, I didn't compare my recovery those first 6 years. I really didn't. I was just glad to be here because I was with people who were like me. And this is a disease of the mind. I didn't realize that either until I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they told me to replace the word compulsive overeater or alcoholic with compulsive overeater. And I really believe that was the beginning of my path of spiritual journey. And if there's anything I could say too, it's like we don't graduate. I've constantly been a work in progress. I still am. And my idea of a higher power, God, has gotten it's evolved, and I am not leaving. I think it continues to grow. In the beginning, it really was people, places, and things. And when I was in the disease, when I was eating, what you thought of me was everything. And it was never good. What my parents thought of me, which was never good, that was everything. And chasing people to validate me and chasing situations to validate me, that was my higher power, which always led back to the food. And the food is just a symptom. That's why I believe I'm an alcoholic. Like, I have the ism. I will always have the ism. So I have to work this program around it. And we were just reading a story at an in-person meeting that I go to, and talking about what you need. You have a spiritual unrest. And if when I was in the hospital for this disease, I remember thinking, God, I was hospitalized twice because of this thing. And it was because my blood sugars were out of control, but really it was because I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm an addict with food. And the only solution is a higher power. I didn't know that until I came here. But a spiritual unrest, if when I was in the hospital and I wasn't at bottom, if you were to tell me, oh, Miriam, you have a spiritual unrest, the solution is God, I would not have been in a place to hear it. It really was when I was down and out, when there was nothing left. I didn't want to be me anymore. I was creating my world, and I was always going to go back to that hell on earth of Miriam being in the food. That was my bottom. That happened right before November 1st, 1998. And my abstinent date is November 1st, 1998. I'm 45 pounds down from my top weight. I was at 175, 25 pounds away from 200, and that was my bottom when I realized if I'm on another diet, I can't do this anymore. I don't want to be me, and I don't know where to go. I only know disease thinking. I only know hell on earth, and I want out. And I'm not going to die tomorrow. I'm going to die in about 5 years at the rate I'm going, and I can't get out of this. And when I surrendered everything, and I meant it with all my heart to the universe, I didn't say God, Jesus, I just said, help me. And I meant it with all my heart. That was the beginning of the universe saying, okay, maybe she's ready. That's my experience. So I went to Monday Night Miracles and I meant it and I said, I need help. And that's when everything in me said, ask that woman to be your sponsor. And I did. And that was the beginning of me surrendering everything and everything changing. And I put the food down. I was uncomfortable that first year. I was a drug addict coming off of drugs. I put the food down. I committed my food. I made this my life. And there was a Thursday night meeting. I'm going to read this. Part of my path of finding God was recognizing that there is something out there. And I started to believe. I started to act as if. I started to believe the women in the rooms and the men who said, this is what we're doing. It was the evidence of them losing the weight, keeping it off, and somehow they're happy. They're laughing and they're not miserable and they loved me. And so every Thursday night, this one meeting that my sponsor would tell me to meet her at, by the way, I did not want to go. So it really was contrary action away from Miriam and her self-will, her thinking. So Thursday night, this one meeting, it was in Sherman Oaks, California, and they would read this. And it really, something else they said too, and I'll say this, what saved me was they would tell me, Miriam, you're new. And when I had my first 30 days of abstinence, they would say that I wasn't allowed to share. I had to listen to those who had 30 days or more. And they would say, your thinking is what got you here, and you need to listen. And maybe if you listen, you'll hear something to keep you here. And I was like, what? But it woke me up. I listened and I was determined to get those 30 days. And I did. But something they read at the beginning was this. And this comes, and I was raised from my sponsor. I talked to my sponsor today about what I should share. She said, share that. So when AA comes of age, this book here, it's all beaten up. I have a thing over it because I read it in my classroom and my students don't know what I'm reading. Isn't that cool? See, this is my book. Anyway, AA comes of age. And this comes from Sam Shoemaker. He was one of the guys that helped us start AA. And every Thursday night, I'd come to this meeting. It was Applied Principles of Alcoholic Recovery, but it was an OA meeting. And the meeting would start out with this. So I'm going to read it to you. And it got me to calm down. It got me to get more in touch with God. And it says here, real prayer is not telling God what we want. It is putting ourselves at his disposal so that he can tell us what he wants. Prayer is not trying to get God to change his will. It is trying to find out what his will is, to align ourselves or realign ourselves with his purpose for the world and for us. That's why it is so important for us to listen as well as talk when we pray. That's why it is good to begin these meetings with silence. Oftentimes we come feverishly and willfully, and we have just got to quiet down before God can do anything for us. While our own voices are clamorous and demanding, there is no place for the voice of God. That is the thing most of us non-alcoholics get drunk on, just willfulness, just wanting life on our own terms. And it is as neurotic as any neuroses ever was. Everybody that is away from God and tries to do his own will in defiance of God is half crazy. Till our own clamorous, demanding voices quiet down, we cannot hear the voice of God. When we let willfulness cool out of us, God can get his will across to us as far as we need to see ahead of us. Dante said, and his will is our peace. One more paragraph. There are a lot of people who don't like the weakness that is implied in the word surrender. I was deeply thankful to hear Dr. Tybo use that word. People like to think they are always strong characters who can take care of their own destinies. That is fictitious thinking. Everybody in this world is some kind of weakling, and if he thinks he is not, then pride is his weakness, and that is the greatest weakness of all. So when I heard that, every week for 3 years, it started to really get ingrained in me that there is something out there and it's okay to ask it, him, for help. And I began to, and you know what? The food wasn't becoming an issue. Now, life was becoming an issue. So I've learned now to go to this higher power for life. And over time, what, 27 plus years, which time, by the way, is only time. I'm still and always going to be a compulsive overeater and addict. And I know in my heart that I'm here because I'm not all there. I know that I need to put God, this higher power, first. Not just about the food now, it's about everything. It's everything. And that has helped me to get through times when there was tremendous change. And I've talked about this, but I made sick people my higher power. And it said in the big book that people, places, and things are what dominated us. So I had to make my higher power at the beginning. And for like the first 10 years, I made it really, truly a ghost because I was told I could act as if, I told I could pretend. I was told that it could be anything that but me, and it could be something from my imagination. So I like men. So I made it a man. My ghost was a man that would goof with me and be funny with me and would protect me when I wanted to eat. And I would talk to this higher power all day long, and I wouldn't eat when things were rough. And I would say, I'm either going to eat or you're going to help me through this. It worked. And I'd say, I'm going to act as if you're going to help me, and let's see what happens. I really used it as an experiment. And then all of a sudden, what do you know? I didn't die, and I didn't eat, and everything's okay. And I'd go, okay, maybe there's something to this. So it really was practice. Then I was told that I could physically do things to allow my higher power in. Like I still open the door sometimes and I let my higher power in. I sometimes will talk, I take my purse off the passenger seat when I'm driving to work and I talk to God driving to work. Now, since I moved, and this was a really hard time, I'm going to be honest, I've been in Texas now over 4.5 years and I was so dialed into my OA community in Los Angeles and my sponsor. And the people and everything was LA, what I grew up with. Well, come into a new world in Texas, let me tell you better find God or you're gonna F and eat. And so I've had to find a higher power in ways that I've never ever had to go to in my life. I meditate. Do I like it? Not really, but I do it. I take sponsor direction. I sponsor. I started a meeting here. I didn't do it to be great, I did it to save my abstinence. I work this program because it's everything. Now we have these like, and I must say, being patient and not getting what you want right away and the uncertainty. I mean, I'll tell you, sometimes I feel like I should get a medal for walking through this without using anything or any kind of device, anything to distract me. I walk through it abstinently. Got, and I want to swear, I'm not going to swear. I walk through it abstinently. I cry. I write. And lastly, I'll say this too. I don't know how much time I have. Oh, I got time. Okay, so when I moved to Austin, I really believe that God has intervened now in ways that I couldn't explain. There are a few people in OA that have stayed in contact with me every single day since I've moved. Every day since I've moved. I also call people. I learned that in the rooms too. My sponsor taught me call and talk to two people a day. And I've been doing that religiously for over 27 years. Not because I'm great, it's because I'm afraid not to. Because my life works. My life is great. Well, sometimes, not always. It depends on my perception. Because my perception is the problem. I learned that. My thinking is the problem. So now I go to this higher power. And I learned in the rooms, the Oxford group, and all these people that I believe the big book is divinely inspired, by the way. There is no way that this could be done by one person. It was definitely God to come and save us so that we don't have to go to the food today. But anyway, so I don't know what I was saying. Something about nobody can tell me now because I'm on a Zoom. Okay, so anyways, out here. So I'm walking and I'm like crying and I'm praying. Oh, and then somebody did contact me who I talked to. She told me about a gentleman who's out here in Austin. His name's Father Bill. I'm gonna say it, and if I get in trouble for this, oh well. Father Bill's out in Austin, and he's the one who kind of spearheaded the two-way prayer thing. So when I was out here, I was like, I'll do anything to not eat. I'll do anything. So I started doing two-way prayer as soon as I moved out here, and I do it. And my sponsor said, share about it. Because the truth is that, you know what? It works. And there were times at like 12 o'clock at night here, I'd be so wound up about something and I couldn't eat. And I'd go, okay, God, Help me. You say you exist. Show me. So I would write, Dear God, and I would take, it's ugly. I put everything on paper. Dear God, I effing hate this. I wish I was da 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 da. If you exist, speak through me. Or speak to me. It is through me, but to me. And then it comes down on paper, and then I calm down, and then I go to bed. So this is just one of the practices I do. Now I do all kinds of things to stay close to this higher power. God is not. Once in a while, I do wish that I'd get like a burning bush. And sometimes I do get like license plates. I wish, I look for God everywhere now. And you know what? I don't eat. In fact, I was down a pound this week. I do all the things that program has taught me, but boy, do I talk to a higher power now in ways that I never did before. It's more spiritual now. It's not. I don't even know if it was material. I definitely go less to the material now. I care more about developing my insides and getting closer to this God than driving that fancy car or getting the pretty jewelry. That is not important to me. Used to be growing up, that's all that mattered was that money stuff and how prestigious one appeared or how fancy someone sounded or looked. That outside stuff was the focus. As soon as I came to program, it became more about what can I do to not eat? Now, how can I be happy in this existence of life and not eat? I will say too that it takes effort, it takes action. We come here, it takes action. And that means surrendering ourselves. And it started with putting down the food, being willing to commit, being willing to give up those foods that gave me, it was a trigger, that phenomenon of craving. I learned that too, that it really started with putting down the foods to hurt me. And I really believe that, as soon as I made that decision to be abstinent and not go back to that hell and not go back to that self-will run riot, I can't stay there for long. It's too painful. So I really have to go to this God. But it started with putting down the food. The food is just a symptom, it's just the beginning. And then everything else starts. That's been my experience. And if I'm going to keep abstaining, and really, moving out here, it was like either Miriam, you find God in a whole new way. You can't rely on those things you used to. Where is he? I'll say this too, and then I'll be quiet. So, like yesterday, even yesterday, I'm so not perfect, by the way. Far from it, if you can't already tell. So, yesterday, I was all like, where is this God? My faith is not perfect. Oh my God, no. But yet, but I take the action. That's the key. So I call someone yesterday, and this person's talking to me, says, God is here right now with you. And I was like, oh, okay. Because I still can be like, wait a minute, my daughter said this, and my husband did that, and this is happening. See, and I can get like this, and I think I'm convinced that I will never be done, I will never be cured, that I'm human, and that everything I'm feeling, what I think, what I say, what I do is human. I just don't want to do those things that will hurt me and eventually hurt or hurt someone else that will lead me back to the food. That's really the guiding star these days. I'm not perfect, but boy, do I go to this higher power and I don't eat. And I have good health. I have a great family. I was on my way to death. So if there ain't no proof, maybe my proof is it. And if you don't like this, don't listen to it. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Miriam. Everyone, please give it up for Miriam. Thank you very much for coming and sharing today. Before we go to our next and last speaker, if you can, we encourage you to put your camera on while you're here and be as engaged as possible with this. Thank you for that. And all right, without further ado, let's introduce Josh B.
Thanks, Chris. Hey, everybody. My name is Josh. I'm a compulsive eater. I want to thank Chris for asking me. I got to be honest, though. He asked, and I'm always willing. It's always an honor when someone, reaches out and says, in essence, what they're saying is, I see something in you. I kind of like it. Why don't you come share it with the rest of us? So that always feels good. But then I heard the topic, and I was like, ugh. I mean, I don't know what Chris is seeing here, but obviously something. Chris isn't seeing anything Josh shows up to do, but it's definitely something a power greater than myself. Real quick, I'll just qualify myself. My top way, you know, my abstinence state was April, or actually August 22nd of 2021. I'm at about 4.5 years abstinence. My top weight, the biggest I ever saw, was well into the 400s, 407. You know, I'm currently at 261. It's about as little as I've been since eighth grade. So things are going well in that department. Yeah, I always like to say it, you know, I love programming. There's so many, and thanks to both the speakers, Michael and Miriam, both, you guys did great. And that was the other thing I thought of when Chris reached out to me. I was like, well, at least there's two other speakers to pad the stats. I mean, how badly can I really mess it up? And I always tease. I kind of tease when I give leads and pitches. It's just like I see so many great speakers, and I am by no means a polished public speaker at all. What I am, though, at least for today, and I struggle with this sometimes, I'm grateful for my abstinence, and I'm grateful that I was introduced to a way of life where I don't have to hurt myself with food anymore. And again, just for today, right now, right here in this moment, I'm willing to do anything, you know, at different times, you know, my head will show up and that looks a little bit differently, but I'm willing to do anything if I don't ever have to go back. When I first got the program, I talked to a couple guys and my exact words to them were, I'll literally do whatever you tell me if I don't have to live like this anymore. And if showing up on a Sunday and hopping on a Zoom and then, you know, sharing, yeah, sign me up. But the reason that, you know, I had reservations is in my relationship with God. I don't even know the right word to use. It's been an interesting journey. And it really starts in, you know, our sister fellowship of AA. I got sober before I got abstinence. And really what caused me to want a relationship, even remotely, because I was raised in a religious household, a pretty devout religious household, you know. In both programs, I hear people talk about Catholicism and you know, recovering Catholic. And I always kind of to myself in the back of my head, I always think to myself, well, hold my beer, because you know, I was raised Jehovah's Witness. And my issues with Scott, with God, started at an early age, before, and I don't mean this to be funny, and I definitely don't mean this to be crude, but when I was younger, you know, I'm just growing into manhood. I'm just starting to get hormones. And I found the Sears lingerie catalog. And you know, I started growing into, you know, doing some things that young men do that, or whatever. In the religion I was raised in, there was talks of like the unforgivable sin and things like that. So for almost as long as I can remember, I felt like God was disgusted with me and wanted nothing to do with me. And as I journeyed through drug and alcohol addiction, that darkness got, I mean, unmanageable, at least for me. And so by the time I showed up to any recovery room, I pretty much thought I was screwed, because God had told me to kick rocks years ago, and it was all tied into me making decisions on things that I knew were wrong and things that, you know, and I did them anyway, for whatever reason. I wanted to, it made me feel good, et cetera, et cetera. So by the time I got to any recovery, I was just like, they were talking about God, and I thought, well, if this is the last house on the block, I'm screwed. And really, the only interest I had was you know, I literally burned my life to the ground. Like it was a dumpster fire. There was nothing. Nothing and no one. And so I had really no other options. And you know, self-will painted me into a corner where I really had no other options other than to start listening to these hokey people who were talking about this God thing. And I would have told you I didn't believe in God by the time I first got to recovery. But truth, after doing many inventories and growing, the truth was I 100% believed in God. But what I thought was that God hated me, and it felt a lot better to believe that he didn't exist. than to believe that he was out there and I was in trouble. Now, I spent 14 years before I got to abstinence in AA, and I utilized the program as it's laid out in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the spiritual program of action, steps 1 through 12. And for 14 years, even though I heard many people talk about it, alcohol is but a symptom, the food's but a symptom, and I'm going to get to the food, I promise. But this is just a big part of my story on my relationship with God. But I spent the 14 years before OA utilizing that process to treat my problem of alcoholism, or of alcohol, not the ism, the substance alcohol. And that's with going to meetings and hearing alcohol is but the symptom, and alcohol is not the problem. And I just wasn't hearing it. And so I did that, and I put a pretty decent life together, and I'm almost faking it to make it. First, when I first got to recovery, I would talk about God because that's what everyone was doing, and then I got to a place where it was like, I don't believe this, I don't feel this. It felt very phony to talk about it, so I started just being honest with my truth. Like, I don't know about this God thing. Like, it really freaks me out, but I know that I don't. I know my life's a lot better now than it was before, and it's all due to doing these steps, working through this process. And I believe if you start at step one and you go through 12, depending, it's all on God's timing. But if you, to the best of your ability, start with one and go all the way through 12, things will start changing. And that's been my story. Now we'll fast forward to when I showed up to OA. And then I'm having conversations, like I'm talking to people. I'm looking for that person that can sell me on it. Because I'm the guy in the big book that it talks about, I forget where, but if I can only believe like he believes, I'm going to be okay. Because the truth of the matter is, booze, food, whatever it is definitely not my problem. I'm maladjusted to life. I truly believe that. And the book's very clear, and it's true in my life. Even though I know that I'm maladjusted to life, there's literally nothing I can do about that. I've tried repeatedly. I try in abstinence, regularly to still kind of force my will and to work things out. And it gets very painful regularly. So by the time and like I was trying to say, I'm running around, I'm looking for that person who can sell me on this because I'm missing something. I've struggled many years of treating my recovery program as a math equation, like, A plus B equals C. So I do this plus this, and then the C portion of the equation is God gives me whatever it is. You know what I mean? And for me, really, all I'm ever looking for at the end of the day is I just want to be okay. The reoccurring story in my head is I'm not okay, regardless of what's going on in my life, whether it's at the home, at work, and my friendships, whatever it is, I'm not okay. There's something wrong with me. There's a disconnect. So all that time in AA, I'm trying, like I'm putting a pretty good life together, but I got this impending doom that's really not really affecting me. It's just like a cloud that always follows me, and I feel like I'm missing something. So I'm reaching out to everybody, I'm trying to find that salesman to sell me on this, like help me believe, because I'm not believing. And so I get to OA. And I get the sponsor, and he seems to be semi-intelligent, pretty intelligent. He knows what he's talking about when it comes to the food as problem. He knows what he's talking about when it comes to the food with his solution. He's in the big book. I love all that. I'm like, all right, I told him, I'll do whatever you tell me. So we're working together a couple months, and I was like, oh, I haven't even had the conversation with him yet. So I call him one day and I said, listen, I need you to know me and this God thing. I was like, I don't know what to think about it. I was like, I'm really not on board. I struggle regularly with like the things that we're doing, and we're talking about God, and I thought that this man was going to be the one. I had high hopes that he was going to be the one that sold me on this whole idea. And the words that came out of his mouth were like, okay, God's not real, whatever. And I was like, I was kind of dumbfounded. I was like, what do you mean God's not real? I was like, you're not supposed to say that. You're supposed to sell me this hokey line of shit that I'm probably not going to buy, but that's what I was looking for. And he said, no, he's like, let me ask you a question. He's like, are you screwed when it comes to food? And I was like, absolutely, absolutely. And he's like, since you showed up here 2, 3 months ago, how's your relationship with food been? I was like, man, I'm making it from plate to plate with minimal to no mental torture, which I didn't even know I had all that before I got to OA. Like, I didn't know the crazy, like, I didn't, like, I'm out of town on trips and I don't even realize I'm missing out on these beautiful experiences because right after breakfast, the whole time we're traveling through town, I'm on Yelp and Google looking for lunch. You know, is it going to be enough? Where are we going to go? I didn't even know all that till I got here and I got a little bit of serenity around the food. I didn't even know that. And I told him, I was like, absolutely. I was like, I didn't even know. And he's like, all right. He's like, that's all you need to know. He's like, you don't need to figure out if God's real or whatever. He's like, he's not real. I'm all right with that. If you want to believe God's not real, I'm all right with that. Blew my mind. And I'm like, all right. He's like, but I do know that a part of this process and this relationship you're building with food has been because, you know, you start at step one, you work through step 12. He's like, as long as you're doing that and doing the things that you got to do, I don't care if you believe in God or not. And it just kind of peeled another layer of prejudice away from me. And I can tell you now, so 4 years into four and a half years in abstinence, and I don't know where this shifted. I'm as spiritually thirsty for a relationship with a God that I don't understand, that I'm never going to know. And for the most part, I'm pretty comfortable with all the facts that I'm not going to figure it out. I don't have to know. I don't have any ties to any religious backing, not that I ever will. Currently, you know, my wife is interested and I've attended some services. I feel kind of really weird. That's an outside issue, I would imagine, just with the facts of things. But I am spiritually thirsty to have the relationship with this God. One thing that I've come to realize, and like I said, I wasted a lot of time in AA using those steps to battle my problem of alcohol. And since I've got to OA, I've been blessed with a new clarity, a new realization, whatever you want to call it. Like, food is no different than booze or drugs for me. Food is not my problem. There are certain foods that I stay away from now. And the only role that those foods played in my life were they were literally like the over-counter medication that I used to treat my alcoholism. And for me, what my or my my you know, my compulsive eating and the disease alcoholism. And what that looks like for me, what alcoholism is, and I'm talking in relations to, you know, me treating that with food. It's a spiritual disease. I've gotten to calling it lately. It's a spiritual mental illness. It resides in my head. It's never satisfied. It's always in a hurry. It's aggravated. No one ever acts right. And it's just up here and it's always talking to me. And the real messed up part is, like, if there was some kind of demonic voice that showed up when I, you know, alcoholism was talking to me, it'd be real cool. Could that be easy for me to break it down? But it literally talks to me in my own voice. Like, I really never know what's going on up here, whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, because it's always me. It's always me working through. But what I have come to find, that's what is great about the fellowship, the outreach calls, you know, good sponsorship. I can run these things by people and help get grounded. And when I don't, because I choose to not do that regularly, when I don't do that, what I find, at least my alcoholism, my spiritual disease, is very painful to me. So when I feel like I'm having to muscle through life and that things are tough and uncomfortable, usually what's happening is this voice is talking to me and I'm following it, but it's really just Josh's self-will. And what I found is those steps that I utilized to treat the substance, which is what I thought my problem was. I didn't know that it was literally a medication I was using to treat this disease because I don't like the pain and I just want to be okay. I just want to feel all right. So I use all these substances. I've recently since gotten to OA, started trying to the best of my ability to use the process to treat the actual disease, alcoholism, that spiritual mental illness, that malady that rest in me, that selfishness, that self-centered. And everything about the steps, everything about this program, you know, when I first came in, they said, find someone that's got what you want and do what they do. And in my mind, it's like, I'm going to look for the guy that's hanging out with the pretty girls, who's got a cool car, who's got a cool job, who seems to be doing all right with life, because that's what I want. And that's what I was first looking for when I was hearing things like that. But really what they're saying is find the guy that's spiritually plugged in. Find the guy that has a great relationship with God, that regardless of what's going on in his life, good or bad, seems to be able to stay well grounded. And that's currently, like I said, that spiritual thirstiness for that relationship with God that I don't understand. And even today, I could just wake up tomorrow and still be in that state of mind of like, sometimes I'm on point with my prayers and my meditation. Sometimes I'm on point with my two-way prayers, and sometimes it's a struggle. Sometimes I'm just doing it because it's the only thing I know how to do to get me any kind of relief that isn't abusing some kind of substance that ultimately is going to burn my life to the ground. And sometimes I still get through periods of life where I just don't have the willingness. And all that's okay. I mean, I lean into you guys on those times. I talk about it, I share about it. And I just pray. And I know the realization. That's a scary place for a guy like me. That's a scary place for a compulsive eater like me to be. It's okay if I don't have the willingness to do those things, but it's not lost on me. And I hope I never forget the fact that I could easily tomorrow just wake up. And if I've pulled far enough away and I haven't been able to plug in, I could just easily pick up tomorrow. Like nothing's been cured, nothing's been settled. I wake up every day. And on the good days, I ground in repeatedly because the minute my feet hit the ground every morning, Josh is on me. Like, no one's, I mean, nothing's even happened during the day. And I know they're going to screw me at work. They're not going to act right. I know my wife's already, she's been banging around in the kitchen, making her coffee and stuff. Even though she knew I had 10 more minutes, I could have been sleeping. It's already on me. And I need, on the really good days, God, help me get out of the way. Show me whatever your will is for me. And other than that, I'm coming up on the end. The only other thing I know is I don't know anything. I know when I tried, I got practical experience with life. When I'm trying to do things my way, and it's awful. It's painful. People get hurt. I get hurt. I lose things. It's just bad. I got practical experience where I'm really plugged in, steps 1 through 12, practicing all the principles, prayer, the meditation, the writing the inventories, making the amends when I'm wrong. And when I'm plugged in like that, I'm not saying life's perfect. I still will regularly have issues, but even when I have issues, it goes a lot smoother. And yeah, that's all I got. Again, Chris, thank you. Hopefully someone got something out of that. I know I did. I'm always grateful when someone asks me to talk. So thanks, Chris.
Thank you very much, Josh. Let's thank all of our speakers today, Michael, Miriam, and Josh, for great leads. And again, thank you for showing up and sharing your experience, strength, and hope. We are going to have two readings now. Kathy is going to read first. I've highlighted it. I'm going to share my screen right now. You are going to read the 11-step prayer. And I'm sharing my screen now. Let me know if you need me to move anything.
Happy compulsive eater, grateful to be here today. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there is hatred, I may bring love, that where there is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness, that where there is error, I may bring truth.
Kathy, we're losing you right now.
Oh, you can't hear me?
We can hear you a little bit now. Yeah. So, where there is error, you may bring truth.
That where there is doubt, I may bring faith. That where there is despair, I may bring hope. That where there are shadows, I may bring light. That where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand than to be understood, to love than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds. It is by forgiving that one is forgiven. It is by dying that one awakens to eternal life. Amen.
Thank you very much, Kathy. Now we are going to recognize the 12th tradition. I'm sorry, the seventh tradition. I'm going to post a link into the chat. This will go to the OA San Fernando Valley. If you are able to make a contribution, please do so in whatever way you're willing to and able. And I have asked Caroline to read the 12 traditions, which I am going to post right now.
Hi, I'm Carolyn. I'm compulsive overeater. The 12 traditions of Overeaters Anonymous. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon OA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there's but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscious. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for OA membership is a desire to stop eating compulsively. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or OA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the compulsive overeater who still suffers. Six, an OA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the OA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every OA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Overeaters Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, OA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Overeaters Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the OA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity of the level of press, radio, films, television, and other public media of communications. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all these traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. All right, now we're going to open the meeting up for Q&A, questions and answers. You've heard from Michael, Miriam, and Josh, so you are going to be able to raise your hand and ask a question. Just as a heads up, the last 20 minutes of this meeting, we will have non-recorded shares, non-recorded questions. So this way, if you do not feel comfortable having your voice or your question on a recorded line, you don't have to worry about that. But having said that, start raising some hands and we will throw it to the panel. All right, Craig K, you're up.
This one is for Josh, the man with the magical beard. Things are going really well, and all of a sudden you get a big boom in your life, and you know it's not going to be good. It's all going to go to shit. You know that. You know that. What do you do? How do you get through this and not eat over it?
Right out the gate, I muscle through it. A lot of the times it's like I start freaking out on the inside. I don't not isolate as far as physically with people, but I isolate. I don't talk about it. I recently have been going through some things in my life where I'm just coming out of the tail end of that initial thought. But when I start getting relief is when I start openly talking about it. I, you know, a lot of people in my men's sponsorship family who lead by example with sharing out loud, which I struggle with sometimes too, because I got this story that if you guys really know me, you're not going to love me. You're going to disappear. That's one of the great fears, that I'm going to be alone. But initially it's always, I still struggle with self-will, but ultimately for the solution, it's just like talk to as many people as I can, you know, pray and ask for relief. And it never comes in the timely fashion I wanted to. And seeing the results are always, sometimes it's months for me. And then I look back and I, you know, the steps that I took, I can see where it helped. But in the moment, I just, it's just muscle through, and then muscle memory on the things that you guys taught me when I got here, honestly.
Thank you very much, Craig and Josh, for answering that. If you don't mind, Craig, I do want to throw that question to the rest of the panel, if they have experience with it and they want to share on that.
I'll share. So, you know, there was a person in the rooms that I really held up high, and I was very connected to her, and that went away. And all of a sudden, I mean, just my whole world changed, and I didn't know if I was going to make it. And I have to say that I held on, I felt it. I talked about it to the people I trust. I cried a lot. I kept praying to God, acting as if, and I would look for God to help me through it. And there was one time I was walking. This was about a year and a half in being here, and I was walking and I was praying. I couldn't eat over it. I just had to feel it. And I felt feelings that I had never, I allowed everything in. There was nowhere to go with it except feel it. And I was walking, I was praying, and I'm walking, and God, where are you? And I swear to God, I looked up and there was a bumper sticker, and all it said was on the car, persist, persist. And I was like, oh. You know, walking through abstinence and doing life, because life's, this is what happens in life, you know, walking through it is not easy. And feeling it's not easy, and just having faith that if this higher power can carry us through this, wherever it's been, it's like Ken used to say, he passed, and so I bring his name up, but he would say, you know, God hasn't dropped you this far to not carry you. And I'd be like, oh, okay. And then he would also say, just for today, just for today, just for today. And I go, okay, just for today. I can do enough today. Not about tomorrow, but today. And that's all I got. Thanks.
Thank you, Miriam. Michael, do you want to share on this?
So, Craig, just correct me that th this is like when it all goes south, how do you keep your connection going? Is that basically the question?
Yeah, that's worked. That it hasn't all gone south, but there was a one big boom setback.
Okay, got it. Okay. I will share a quick anecdote on this, which is in my lived experience, the one area of my life that I've really been grossly unsuccessful in is love. I just have not been successful in relationships ever. And I've been single most of my life. And I had basically given up. And then I was here, and it was about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And I met a guy, and I thought, you're the guy. Like, this is it. Like, this is going to be an amazing share for me to give at meetings because after all of this, love showed up, and I was really excited. And then we stood in a parking garage one night, and he friend zoned me and said, "Look, I just want to be friends." And I didn't. But I was devastated because there was this feeling in my head that this is it. This was my last shot before the window closed completely. And I got hammered. And I came home. And when I get depressed, I don't put any lights on. I live in the dark. That's really how you know I'm depressed. And I remember going to bed that night and saying over and over, how come it's not my turn? How come I never get a turn? Why does everybody else get a turn and I don't get a turn? And I was really clogged, I've got to tell you. And I didn't eat over it because of the two-way prayer thing, because I was really angry at God. And I just said, this is like the rug pulled out from under me. And I'm tired of this. I'm really tired. I've done everything you've asked, and I don't get the reward for it. And then God said two things to me. God said, are you abstinent? And I said, yes. He said, well, then you did get the reward. And then I fired back and said, but why don't I get this? And here's the answer I got. Because you don't. Like, okay. Wow. All right. Like, that's rough. But what it really showed me was that we always emphasize on the if only, and if I, you know, if I only had this, everything would be perfect. And we don't take what was for me was a wake-up call that my gratitude list was too short and was not being enunciated or reflected upon or read enough. And so I pivoted there and really do an aggressive gratitude list every day because I have a lot. I mean, I really do. I have a lot that a lot of people don't have and wish they had. And instead of looking at what I don't have, this thing, which I didn't get, and okay, that's fine, but I have all of this that other people don't get. They'd kill to have. So why don't we just lean into that instead? But it took that kind of earthquake emotionally to get there. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Josh, Miriam, and Michael, and Craig for the question. All right. Would anyone else like to ask a question? Allison S.
Sure, I'll ask a question. Allison, compulsive overeater and restrictor, and of course, I'm a Josh fan. However, I'll just ask a general question and have all three answer. As somebody else said, it's like I feel like I'm well grounded. I'm in the 12-step program, two of them, obviously the beverage program and the food program. I feel like I work the steps. I feel the pink cloud, the higher power. Everything's great in the morning. And as soon as I step out the door and deal with people, that it's like a dark cloud or something like a, what is it? The ground shakes and I can't deal with life on life's term. And then I get frustrated with my higher power when he doesn't answer my prayers. And it's like a feels like a day-to-day thing. So I didn't know what, how do you guys keep yourself grounded, well grounded and joyful, and I might add you, when there's chaos and people that are sad or angry or depressed and their energy is just sucking the life out of you. And of course, for Josh, I would use the, like if, when you go to work and it feels like everyone's just crazy, and then anyone else that wants to answer the question. But thanks. All right, Josh, you can be the first one to
Yeah,
answer.
you go first, Sean.
All right. Yeah. So for me, like nothing, like I'm not wired to lean into God. I'm not wired to look for the solution. So for me, it's always about pain and pain threshold. And what I found is through all my years in recovery, like my threshold for pain has dropped dramatically. So on the good days, and that's and the good days for me are when like I'm just in the motions of working my program, doing what I have to do. On those days, I think of it earnestly. Some days, I'm dropping thy will, not mine regularly. Those days are like, please take this from me. But still, then again, the only way I know how to do it, and sometimes I must, like I said, I'll muscle through. And it's all about when I finally cry uncle. It's like what I'm not willing to put into this program, usually, and I'm not saying it's God smiting me, and I don't know how to articulate it, but what I'm not willing to put into the disease, that's the way I'll put it. The disease will humble me quickly. And it's all about like how quick do I want the relief? Because I know what to do. And how quickly do I want to get out of the way? I don't know if that answered your question, but that's kind of what I was thinking as you were asking it.
Miriam or Michael?
Should I go, Michael? I'll go. Okay. It's kind of like, when you're abstinent, you can only feel it for so long until like it becomes too painful, And it's either feel it and work the steps on it, do your writing. I was taught that if, writing is like getting it out of me, it's the physical action of getting it out of me and putting it somewhere. And so, resentment, they creep up all the time, and we can either hang on to it or we can finally address this and get peace over it. But it takes effort, And that's the thing. It's like we either don't address it. This is just my experience, but we either don't address it and it stays there. And then we keep putting ourselves in suffering, but we address it and say, God, help me. If you exist, these steps, whatever it is that's guided us out of this hell, help me. And then what comes to me is, I don't have the exact, I can't find it. But somewhere in the big book, it says, if only things could manage well, if we could only make it manage better, if, somehow they could do what we want managing well. That's all that comes to me. But there's always going to be stuff. I mean, gosh, there's always, I got five different things going on in my life right now, but what comes first is my abstinence. I protect my abstinence more than it. That has to be number one. And then the rest works itself out, but we have to take the action, always. Do I want to, by the way? Hell no. Half the time I complain, but I don't want to hang on to this stuff either. So it's kind of like, how much do I have to take this before I finally get it out of me? So that's all I have.
I'll finish, Allison. Thanks so much for the question. So it's my brain is such a sieve. I mean, I was I instantly thought of this old soap opera that was I watched when I was a kid, and there was a famous scene where the woman and she said, "I don't want to look at the world through rose-colored glasses. The world should be rose-colored." And the pink cloud thing always reminds me of that. Because the pink cloud, I mean, dissipates, and that's what happens, and then you're left with life. And for me, it's been such a program learning curve. My brother, who I'm really close to, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer last year, a month after he retired, and then was dead 4 months later. And I flew back to Philadelphia to do all of that with my sister-in-law and the rest of it, blah blah blah. It's a long story, it doesn't matter. But what does matter is that I showed up for her and my nephew in a way I never could have showed up if I was in the food. And for me, it was a reinforcement that the program is not here to make sure that life is always rose-colored. The program is here to get us through life when it's not. And I was able to be of service in the true definition of the word service, in a way that was profoundly meaningful to my sister-in-law and frankly to me, because I have these tools in the toolbox, these nine tools, and a program that emphasizes that I'm not in this alone. So that's what I lean into when the times get tough. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Allison, for the question and panel for answering. I'll throw a question out there. My abstinence and program are solid. And like that was said by I believe it was Josh, he has a thirst for the spiritual side of this, which I also have never experienced until the last couple of years, where I'm more open to like, wow, like what else is there for me in regards to spirituality and God and my higher power? And over the last few weeks, few months, things have been very difficult, and I've gotten a lot of wondering what's the point of this? So my question is, how do you if you have either practical advice or just just in general, what is it that you do during the day that would like, how do you keep on seeking? Is my question. How do you keep on seeking spiritually, even after hit after hit? And I'll even throw it on the other side, even when things are great, when things are, it's like, wow, things couldn't be better. Why bother keep seeking? What's the point? So yeah, I'll throw that out, and you, whoever wants to answer first.
All I'll
right,
go
go for
first
it.
this time.
I will.
Is that all
Oh,
right?
go ahead. Whoever
All
said
right.
that, please.
Thanks. Shake it up. I'll just answer briefly by saying, to me, my relationship with God, I have some really deep friendships and I have some really deep family relationships. Then I have casual friendships and casual family relationships. The difference is how much effort do I put in? How important are they to me? And how much communication do I sustain with somebody? To show them that they're important to me. And it's the same thing with God. God has to come first. So if I'm not in contact and if I'm not reaching out, if I'm not doing the work, I'm not doing the footwork, then that connection is unstable. And to me, that means the last thing I say every night before I go to sleep is thank you, God, no matter what's going on, no matter how lifey life is, because it's my connective tissue. And the first thing I do every morning is I read For Today and Voices of Recovery because they keep me connected to this program and to something bigger than me. And to me, it's the connective tissue thing. That's the thing, is that if I stay connected, I always have that thing to pull whenever I need to pull it. And sometimes that's just a check-in in the car. Sometimes that's just, 5 minutes of chitter chatter when I'm taking a walk. It doesn't matter. It's not elegant all the time, but it's consistent. And to me, consistency wins the game when you really want to feel that sort of sense of calm and equanimity.
All right. And then for me, you said something So one of my main problems is you said something, especially like even when times are good. I always say this in my experiences, this program, these spiritual principles, they work so well, I regularly quit doing them. And that tends to be my MO. What happens is I am plugged in, usually some kind of catalyst of something painful. I'll get plugged in and then I'll do it, and then we'll get through that. And I'll keep doing it for a little bit, but things start getting so good, I slowly start backing it up. But when I'm plugged in, like the practical application, usually in the morning, there's prayers. I read something spiritual in nature. Like currently, I'm reading a book called, it's not approved literature, but it's just spirituality of imperfection. I read Upon Awakening, kind of take the suggestions as they come out of the book, like thinking about my day ahead. I try to pray regularly throughout the day. I try to stay focused on, like, I'm going to check in because, like Michael said, if the relationships are important, and that includes, like, for me, meditation. Like, I have relationships in my life where those people are doing a lot of the talking, and it's like I don't really enjoy answering the phone when they call as much as those that interact and we actually have a back and forth conversation. So prayer is me talking, meditation is me trying to listen the best I can. So during the course of the day, at least throwing out some prayers, and then at the end of the night, just when we retire at night, I break it down as simple as reading when we retire at night and answering the questions as they come out, like where was I resentful, dishonest, blah, blah, blah. And so as far as that goes, that's what that looks like in my life, especially when I'm plugged in. But again, like I said, it works so well. My prayer is always that I get the willingness where I continue that because I want that relationship to be that important to me. So that's what I got.
I was programmed a certain way, and this program to just do the same thing every day, and that's the rituals that have really sustained me through thick and thin. And so, like in the mornings, I get up every morning, 5 a.m. Take sponsee calls, but the first thing I do is write down my food for the day, and then I say, "Dear God, thank you for this day," and then I read the OA for today and the AA 24 hours a day. I write it out, the morning parts of the bottom parts. And then I ask God what he wants me to do for today. And I will say, "God, I am having a heart, fuck you." I'm swear. I do. I do. And I don't wanna. And then I'll get in the car, and I'll be honest, sometimes I'm in the car and I blast the music and I'm like, I talk to God and I scream in the car. I make sounds in the car, like I'm like, ah, and then as soon as I get out of the car, I'll just say, "God, I just can't do this. Please take over." And I heard a saying like, "Cover me in the blood, God." I heard this from somebody. Just cover me in the blood. And when I say that, it's like the blood becomes him. And then I can speak. And then I can do the day. And sometimes I have to take it hour by hour and write it on paper, write it on post-its. Help me to understand and to be understood. A line from the St. Francis prayer. And then I'll do that. I stop and make phone calls, and I tell the truth to the people I call. Sometimes I call others who I know are struggling. And then I go to a meeting in the evenings, or I go walking and I talk to God and call people. And then at night, I don't do a 10 step every night, but if I get wound up about stuff, I write about it a lot. That's my thing. I do two-way prayer, and it's sustained me. And like I said, I mean, there are times when I'm just like, my faith is so low. And I heard a longtime alcoholic talk about this, a man I really respect in AA, and he's got 30 years and he's great. And he was saying that his faith wavers. Here's a guy who's an incredible speaker. He's powerful dude in my eyes, and he says his faith wavers. And I need to hear that, that this is an ongoing, like, where are you? This is hard, but we do the routines anyways. And I think it is what saved me so far. Thanks.
Thank you very much, all three of you, for sharing. I did see Flower Mama Bree had their hand raised. Do you have a question for the panel? Okay. Does anyone else have a question for the panel? Amy, you're up.
Let me set my own timer. Hold on. Okay. My sponsor asked me, and since you guys are here, I'll ask you to be very intentional about how do I turn my will in my life, right? Made a decision to turn my will in my life over to the care of God. So very intentionally, I'm looking for how can I do that? And the only thing, like I came up with something after I hadn't done it. Like I try to tell the people at the grocery store how to bag my groceries. And I was like, ooh, that was a missed opportunity. And then I had another one where I was on the road and I was like going 75 and the speed limit 65. And I was like, oh, that's one. I can bring it down to 65 and turn my will out. Do you guys do that, or do you have other ways that you practice step three? That's my question. Thanks.
I'll go if that's right. So turning your will in your life means to me being willing to live with answers you don't want. This is what I talk about in the two-way prayer thing. I went for a really fancy job that I really wanted. There were 1,000 people who applied. I made it to the top two, 8 rounds of interviews, the whole thing. Didn't get the job. And the thing is, during that process, I said to God the entire time, look, lay out the path. If I'm meant to go, I'm going to get this. And if I'm not meant to go, you'll tell me not. So I didn't get the job. So that seems like, okay, you got an answer, right? Except I didn't like the answer. So what I learned was you can't ask God to lay out a path for you. And then when you see the path, say, I don't like this path. Give me another one. That's not how it works. That's why there's a whole chapter in the big book called How It Works. Because you have to be constantly reminded that you're not running the show. And so I didn't like that path. I didn't, but you know what? I have to trust it. And to me, the whole turning the will is how much do you trust it? Do you really buy into this? Are you really in it? Do you really trust it so that you take action based upon what's laid out for you by your higher power when you get it, or do you not? And that's really where the footwork comes in. And for me, that's it. I trust it and I'm going to go with it. Thanks.
I'll share something. So my daughter, she wouldn't hear me saying this. She has not liked Texas, and so we moved here so she could go to school here. And my son, so she says to me yesterday, "Mom, what if I go to the community college for 2 years out here, and then I go to Los Angeles to go to the community college there, so I can get the credits I need to go to UCLA like you, Mom? How about I go to UC? Because I always wanted to go to UCLA, Mom. I don't like Texas here." And this was this morning, or yeah, this morning, and I was like, "Wait, what?" So I made a call, and I talked to somebody in the program, who's a mom of teenagers, and she gave me her experience, strength, and hope. And so, instead of me saying, "We moved here for you," we moved, wait, what? I just kind of said, "Honey, I support you 1,000%. Whatever you need, I love you." And I was like, that is not me. I had this whole vision of how it should be laid out, and I am learning how to change my thinking about this. And it's the practical way of doing it is like I make phone calls from people that I believe when two people come, I learned this, when two people come together in his name, he is here. And it can't be Miriam and her self-will. And I still can think I know something. And the scary part is I do. I do know things, but I can't act on it. I have to surrender and trust. And I kind of go to like a council of OA people. It helps me do things that is not me. And it's all day long, like I have students where I just have to keep my mouth shut. And I learned this too, in program, it's kind of like if you keep your mouth shut, you can't get yourself in trouble. So I keep my mouth shut a lot. And it's really practicing contrary action. It's always practice, though. That's something else I learned is that this is all practice. I don't think we master it. If we practice it enough, maybe we get better at it, but I don't know if that helps.
And for me, the simple answer is love and service. But what makes it not simple for me is I'm not wired for love and service for whatever reason. And I quit trying to figure that out too. the book talks about, and I forget exactly where in the book, it's towards the end of the step process. What we're doing as we go through that process is fitting ourselves to be a maximum service to God and our fellows. And again, like I said, for whatever reason, I'm not wired like that. Like I'm wired for like, what's in it for Josh? Like Josh can be nice to get what he needs. He can also turn nasty if he thinks, bullying his way through to get what he needs. So the only way I know, is staying plugged in into the process. And when I say the process for me, it's the spiritual principles in all 12 of the steps. So, it starts off, in the beginning and then even in the end. And for me, it included, like for many years, I didn't do this, but it includes making all my amends, it regularly taking a look at myself. And when things crop up, acknowledging them, talking to people about them, cleaning that stuff up when it happens. And that, like I said, that's really all I know. If it weren't for like the program, the book, and the process, I treat it just like a roadmap or a recipe. And I just follow it to the T. It's about as, I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed, so I try to keep it as simple as possible. And that's as the book's pretty clear for me when I, especially when I got someone that knows before me, knows what's going on and can help me navigate that. It's pretty clear on what I need to do. And as long as I stay plugged into that, I'm doing pretty good. Thanks.
Thank you very much, guys, and thank you, Amy, for the question. We are now going to, that's going to be the end of the recorded portion of the workshop. I am going to stop the recording now.